Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Shakespeare and Company. In a remote Mennonite community, a group of men have been drugging and raping women, blaming the attacks on ghosts and demons. The rapists have been arrested, but will be bailed in only a few days, after which the women will, quote, be given the opportunity to forgive these men, thus guaranteeing everyone's place in heaven. Recognising the threat the men's return represents, a group of women, daughters, mothers, grandmothers, meet in a hayloft to discuss how best to protect themselves. What follows is a conversation that is urgent and fraught, but also lively and galvanating, as these eight women, despite the lack of any formal education, find their voices and, in doing so, learn from each other how to channel their rightful outrage. By focusing her nimble authorial mind on a very specific situation, Miriam Taves achieves a clarity of insight and expression that allows women talking to reflect not just upon the specific case of the Mennonites, or indeed other avowedly patriarchal societies, but the conspiracy of forces that oppress women and minority groups the world over. Written as an imagined response to real events, Women Talking blends the moral lucidity of the parable with the visceral brutality of truth, and is, to my mind, one of the most remarkable novels of recent years. Miriam Taves has published four other novels, including the much-loved All My Puny Sorrows, as well as a memoir of her father. She's a recipient of numerous literary awards, including the Governor's General Award, the McNally Robertson Book of the Year Award twice, and the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize. In 2007, she made her screen debut in the film Silent Light, for which she was nominated for Best Actress at Mexico's Ariel Awards. Lisa McInerney wrote of Women Talking that it's a considerable achievement to have written so sensitively and yet so compellingly about such brutal crimes, calling it a novel for the times, while Catherine Lacey declared it a modern classic, as real and warm and terrifying as a pail of fresh blood, adding that Women Talking was a perfect work of art. Please join me in welcoming Miriam Taves to Shakespeare and Company. I mentioned the Mennonites, but I suppose it's quite possible for people who haven't read the book that they might not be aware of what exactly or who exactly the Mennonites are. And I was just wondering if you could give us a little introduction to this quite particular group of people.
Certainly, yeah. Mennonites are, there's so many versions, the short, the long, the very long, similar to the Amish. Mennonites started as a breakaway group, a breakaway from the Catholics in the 1500s in northern Holland, in the province of Friesland. So that's where the Mennonites began, I guess, and then have a history of constant movement and migration from place to place to place, constantly in search of a place where they're able to practice their religion. And the central tenets of the religion, of the faith, of the Mennonite faith, are pacifism, and they're an Anabaptist sect, so adult baptism and kind of communal living outside. One of the main, I guess, mottos of the Mennonites, in the world, but not of the world. So then there are very different ways, many different ways of being a Mennonite in the world. For instance, I am a Mennonite, and I dress like this, and I live in a city, and I'm educated, and I'm a secular Mennonite. I was a member of the church. I was baptized as a 15-year-old, which is what they consider to be the age of adulthood, really, in a sense, and then was in the church and was excommunicated in my early 20s. And I come from a Mennonite community in Canada. We're the first Mennonite settlement in Canada. My group came from Russia. And the Mennonites and this is a very conservative, rule-based, very religious, patriarchal, authoritarian, fundamentalist community. And the Mennonites the Mennonites of the Manitoba colony, which are the Mennonites in the book, and the place where the real crimes, these rapes, occurred, also come from. They made the same migration from Holland to Prussia to Russia to Manitoba, where I'm from, and then this group, like so many other groups, broke away and went further afield, in a sense, first of all to Mexico, then to Bolivia. And so there are always in search of a place where they can, you know, practice their religion and be, you know, really, really, really off the grid, as they say. And so different governments, different countries will sell or even give land to the Mennonites, you know, knowing that they're, you know, for the most part, good farmers. They can contribute to the economy, et cetera, et cetera. They'll stay out of trouble. And so these are self-policed, self-governed communities, and so that's, yeah. So again, it's, you know, there are just so many different ways of being secular, liberal, ultra-conservative, old order. Mm.
And when you heard about the crimes that that from which this book is inspired, I'm not sure it's quite the right word, but right. which you imagined, the real events from which this book is imagined. Was it sort of an immediate thought of, that you would write about it? Was it something that your proximity, your background in the Mennonite religion, was it something that you felt allowed you sort of a greater access to writing about it, a greater legitimacy? Or was it the reverse? Was it something that because of that proximity, it would have been quite a frightening undertaking?
Mm-hmm. No, the first, absolutely. When I first heard about the crimes, the rapes, in 2009, I think the first media report happened in 2009, and I think it was in The Guardian. I was horrified, like everybody else. I wasn't surprised, knowing what I know of these communities. And I had thought at the time, actually, the opposite of frightening me, it fueled my kind of ongoing rage or incredulity towards my own community, the Mennonites, and particularly, you know, the way that you know, the patriarchal structure, the hierarchy of these communities, and the lack of genuine loving forgiveness, tolerance, which is what is preached, and so it's something that I've been, you know, kind of acutely aware of, and constantly, you know, like I've said many times, I seem to have a kind of perpetual adolescent relationship with my own community, and that I'm constantly, you know, finding, you know, calling out the you know, the hypocrisy and the violence that occurs there, not just physically, and not just girls and two girls and women, two boys and men as well, and the violence not to the spirit, to the psyche, you know, and yet at the same time, you know, as an adolescent, I still have this longing to be welcomed back. You know, not that I would go back. I just want to be welcomed back. And, you know, again, it is all I can do is describe it as an adolescent. It's immature, but it's but it seems not to go away. And so when I heard about these crimes, I definitely thought, yeah, this is something that I want to think about more, and I want to create something with and write something about. I just didn't know exactly how I would do it.
And that how was going to be my next question, in fact, because formally the book is very interesting as well. It's sort of, it is this, so it's essentially the minutes of several extended meetings of these eight women. So their conversations documented by August, who's a member of their, a male member of their community. And I'm curious about how you arrived at that particular format.
It was a roundabout kind of, you know, as I'm sure the writers here today would know, like it's, I think at first, when I first started, I was talking a lot about it with my sister, who had connections there in the colony. We're all related. We're talking about it, and that's such for me, it's the most difficult in a way. I think part of the process is how, you know, I know what the story is. I think I know where it's set and who the characters are and what the theme is, but how am I going to, you know, how am I going to structure it? And so I thought about it for a long time. At first I had ideas of writing some kind of revenge story, and then quickly realized that you know, I'm really not a vengeful person, and it doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense sense with these characters, with Mennonites, for these Mennonite women. And so, and I also realized that the and then I decided that I wanted the women to have a conversation about it. I didn't want to recreate or reenact the rapes themselves. I wanted it to be after the aftermath, what are they going to do, like you said, the imagined response, and I wanted there to be an urgency to it, so a short time, 48 hours, and I knew that basically that, yeah, and it just sort of, so it kind of came to me gradually, and that you know, essentially, there would have to be a male narrator if I was being true to the place, to these people, to my characters, because the women, the girls, and the women are illiterate in these conservative colonies, and so for them to be taking the minutes, as it were, of their meetings, you know, a male would have to do it, and so but essentially the male narrator is, he's August, and he's also a disenfranchised Mennonite. He's considered a half man basically, or not a man by the other Mennonite, you know, within that context of the Mennonite colony. He's not a farmer. He's not strong. His sexuality is questioned. He has been away. He was thrown out of the colony as well, along with his family. And, In the book, it's Ona, who is one of the women in talking, and she and August have always sort of loved each other in a way, and she senses that he's come back to the colony, and she senses that he's very troubled, he's despairing, he's suicidal, and out of an act of compassion, she says to him, you know, August, she senses this about him, and she says, August, just come with us. Come with us to the loft. We're going to be talking. We women, we have something to do here. We have something to work out. You can, you know, you've had a fancy education in, you know, in England. You can write the notes. So basically, she's giving him this task that to the women is irrelevant, but to him, it allows him to basically to bear witness to what the women are saying. So it's an inversion, really, of, you know, the women are the philosophers and the thinkers and the doers and the planners, and he is the secretary, essentially. And in the end, the minutes don't matter anyway. They're irrelevant because the women can't read them, and they have more important things to do. And the hope is that the women, of course, will go on to write their own stories, and that August will, in his role as a teacher, begin to take what he's learned from the women in the loft and re-educate the boys. Mm. This is all, you know, in my head. You know, this is all like after the book ends.
But this interesting, you say the women are the philosophers and the thinkers and the doers. And I think that was one of the first things that struck me about the book, is when you, when one reads about oppressive communities, and particularly when, for example, women are uneducated and illiterate, I think, unfortunately, we tend to sort of project a lack of sophistication to thought. And one thing that is clear immediately is that the women, they might not be able to write, they might not have the specific philosophical or political terms, but they have the reason and the means to arrive at very complex, very sophisticated philosophical conclusions. Mm-hmm. And it just really struck me that was sort of, was that something which you were keen to sort of get across right from the beginning, and to sort of upturn our preconceptions?
Absolutely. That, you know, and that certainly was a challenge, given, you know, their collective sort of communal, very limited experience in the world. And so, you know, for them to have this discussion, which is, you know, theological, philosophical kind of, you know, and all, it takes place within the context of their faith as well, which was also important to them and to me to get across. And I think that that was certainly a challenge. August, you know, can act as a sort of, he can interpret some of the stuff using some of the language that he would be familiar with, patriarchy or commodity or these types of things, which the women, words, concepts that the women just wouldn't have. But like you say, they have the reasoning, they have the ability to think that way just without the specific language. And then again, the idea of language as, you know, as a tool, you know, as a revolutionary tool. I mean, language is powerful. And oppressive at times, especially in the way that the Bible, in their case, you know, the fundamentalist interpretation of it and the misogyny inherent in that. And it was also important to me to show that these women are real. So not only to be kind of mouthpieces of something that they wouldn't necessarily say, or some kind of academic argument, but also to show that they're real, that they tease each other, they attack each other, they argue, they are subversive, they mourn, they cry, they contradict themselves, they fight, I know that the perception of Mennonites is especially, you know, similar again, you know, as we were saying at the beginning, to the Amish, in that, you know, they're this kind of crazy, kind of cultish, sort of backward medieval group of religious freaks who have, you know, decided to live like this way, and all the kind of crazy shit that goes down in those places and these communities. And there's, you know, and I wanted to sort of, you know, alter that a little bit and show that, you know, these are human beings, to get across, you know, their urgency, the agency that they need to acquire, but also their humanity.
Mm. One other way I think that comes across really distinctly is in the sort of the intergenerational relationships as well. So we see some teenagers acting very much like any other teenager, and then you have the sort of the mothers and the grandmothers, and there's sort of the dynamic between the three generations. I think it was really effective in kind of closing that gap between this religious community who have their sort of weird ways that we can never understand, and just seeing the same sort of rhythms and the same dynamics playing out in their lives and in their interactions as we see.
And writing the teenagers, the teenage girls too, was a lot of fun always, you know, bearing in mind the pain and the trauma that they're embodying, but to be a teenager and in this context where there are women talking about, you know, these very important, you know, the opportunity for, you know, for mockery of that, for sarcasm, for, you know, kind of boredom and different, you know, and their crushes on the various boys in the community and their own life and their own friendship and their own secrecy. Stuff that they say and do, you know, apart from the women, all of that teenage stuff was fun too. It was a nice, and I think it was a break. It was a break for me as the writer, and maybe it is a little bit of a, you know, break for the from the you know, intensity of the conversation. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, the intensity of the conversation, and also I guess the sort of the ambient intensity of the events and the situation as well. I mean, you said that you don't describe the attacks at all, but there is occasional kind of punctual references to them, and that was something that I had to, in a sense, kind of keep reminding myself, was like this is because there is an air a little bit of a sort of, not exactly a parable, but of something a bit out of time. I think some of it's been referred to in a couple of reviews as kind of almost like a timeless piece of work, and then you drop in these references. Not at all graphic to some of the crimes, and it sort of brings the reader up short and just reminds us of the brutality actually of what went on, and it just seems particularly striking. Did you have to sort of negotiate that sort of ambient intensity, that sort of violence in the writing of it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it has with the rhythm and the pacing and the, because of course within the conversation, you know, there are moments of I suppose a degree of, you know, levity and jokes and humorous stuff. But then it's very important to, you know, the women are there. These things have happened to them, and they're there for a reason. And so, you know, writing it was important to always have that inside of myself as well, which made me really want to finish the book, and to, you know, with the pacing, to bring it up to, you know, to, for instance, yeah, the teenagers fooling around in a funny way, and then to include a reminder that, for instance, you know, the 3-year-old daughter of one of the women has a venereal disease, and one of the older women has a badly fitting set of false teeth, you know, because hers were smashed right out of her mouth.
Yeah. It's those details, as I said, that sort of. That, yeah, as a reader, you just, it brings you up short, and you just, yeah, have to take a bit of a breather and just sort of it grounds you in quite a profound way. But early on in the conversation, the women come up with essentially three options. So what they can do, the options being do nothing, stay and fight, or leave. And again, you had that feeling that this is a very specific discussion about a very specific set of circumstances. And yet, do nothing, stay and fight, and leave seem to be three options which apply to almost every situation of oppression one finds.
Absolutely, whether it's... and the stakes are high for each one of them. I mean, they're all fraught, uncertain, dangerous options in a sense, and not an easy decision to make. And you're right. I mean, this is kind of... I mean, in any oppressive situation that we find ourselves in, or not even something that we might re-characterize as oppressive, but just uncomfortable or where we're unhappy, what do we do? You know, do we stay at a job, in a marriage, in university, in a program, whatever it is? It's always, stuff that we're all grappling with, I think, almost all the time.
Mm-hmm. And then that understanding of, for example, leaving. Is there a difference between leaving and fleeing? Like, is there sort of that the connotations of, in taking flight, is that a surrender? Is that a show of weakness, or is that a show of strength? In fact, and this is something which between the eight of them, they sort of unpick as the.
Yeah, they're very concerned about, again, about language, about the difference in these words. Are we leaving or are we fleeing? Are we running away like a terrified animal, in a sense? Or are we making a conscious choice to leave? And this is important.
Mm. Well, concerning the language, one thing I don't think we have said explicitly is, of course, as well as documenting the conversation, August Epp is also translating it. Mm. So the women are talking in, I don't know about my pronunciation, Plautdeutsch?
Yeah, Plautdeutsch.
Plautdeutsch, okay. So August is listening to it and then translating it into English as they converse. And I'm just curious about the language itself. Because earlier you said language could be liberating or it could be very constraining. Is that a language which has remained relatively... static since the foundation of the colony, or is it one which has sort of evolved in order to sort of allow the expansiveness of the conversations that these women have?
The language itself, yeah. I don't think it has evolved from what I know and from what people tell me, people who, are more, informed. No, it's a dying language. Mm-hmm. It's a language that only Mennonites speak, really. Although today I was doing an interview at the hotel and suddenly there was a woman, I was talking with the woman interviewing me, and suddenly there was a woman standing there and she said, "I speak Plautdeutsch." And I said, "Oh, then you're a Mennonite." "No, but I'm from Friesland." And so she was, in contact with Mennonites. So anyway, that was just, but it's a dying language. It's certainly a language that, my parents' generation, that was their first language. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. My mother still speaks it with her friends, with her Mennonite friends, her older Mennonite friends. My sister spoke it, a little bit, and I don't really speak it at all. My parents, like so many Mennonite parents who are a little bit more liberal, and again, like I think, like so many parents, just in general, didn't want us really to learn the language. Wanted us rather to learn English. And although you might wonder how that worked out for me as I bumble along here, so that we would be okay in the world. There was even that understanding of my parents' generation that even though they might not be in the world, that my sister and I would be, our generation would be, we would need to be. Of course, now we know, of course, that we are all capable of learning more than one language, or even two or three, but that was the thinking at the time. So it is a dying language. Mm-hmm. It's an unwritten language. Mm-hmm. It is the language of the women in the book, the women in real life in these closed colonies. It's the only, they don't speak the language of the country that they're in. And again, the language is unwritten. They're illiterate. And so, they are virtual prisoners. And that, again, you know, speaks to the importance of language and to its you know, revolutionary aspect and its liberating aspects and its oppressive language. And, you know, when that's denied, I mean, there's a large part of you that is also denied. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you know, they really are, they're held hostage in mm-hmm. these places. They don't leave the colonies without being accompanied by a man, a brother, or husband, or whatever. So for instance, when these types of crimes occur, there's no recourse, there's nowhere for them to go, there's no way that they can ask for help.
And the way the language can kind of act as a prison itself, like you said earlier, that August, who has lived out, he provides the word patriarchy to them. And that was obviously a very sort of resonant moment, because they are talking about something and describing something which the language doesn't have a word for. And it's just interesting to think that, yeah, how much is one able to imagine a concept, to understand a concept, if one isn't able to name it?
Right, and they refer to, and they talk about the Bible, you know, in that way too. I mean, it says, you know, we've been told, you know, by the men, the religious leaders, the male leaders in the community, you know, that this is what it says in the Bible, this, and this. And of course, you know, that is always translated or interpreted by the men as that benefits the men, and you know, and slowly, of course, over time, dehumanizes the women, and you know, and the women talk about this, and they say, well, how do we really know that that's what it says in the Bible? You know, and I think one of the things that was so threatening to the Mennonite religious patriarchy, for instance, that I've always been like kind of in the ring with, like how many rounds, it's endless, but you know, who would prefer that I basically shut up or die even, but of course they're Mennonites, they're pacifists, so I get away with a lot. They can only, they're so frustrated. but you know, that is what is so threatening about this book, you know, specifically is that, you know, these women are talking and, in fact, in a way, you know, creating their own religion, you know, extrapolating from the old, you know, with all of the beautiful aspects of the Mennonite faith and of many faiths, you know, love, compassion, tolerance, you know, and trying to create something where they can engage with and be safe in and genuinely worship.
Mm-hmm. And one of the sort of specific areas that they particularly take issue with is around the idea of forgiveness. Now, I mentioned that there's a moment where you write that the women will be given the opportunity to forgive these men, thus guaranteeing everyone's place in heaven. And it seemed to me that sort of structurally this idea of forgiveness has been, as you said, sort of twisted or sort of constructed to benefit the men to the oppression of the women. And it's interesting to see how throughout the conversation, despite, again, not necessarily knowing that they're doing this explicitly, the women sort of unpick this concept and realize that sort of that can be extrapolated into questioning a lot of the kind of founding tenets of the religion.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the idea of it's sort of the Mennonite version of restorative justice in that, you know, when something like this happens, and this, of course, is a, you know, extremely horrific, egregious crime, but you know, the even lesser crimes, if such a thing exists, if that's the way to describe it. But you know, the idea is that the perpetrator of the crime says, I did this, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? That the person that was violated says, yes, I forgive you, and that's it. And you think, in a sense, I mean, the idea of the concept of forgiveness is a beautiful thing. I believe in forgiveness. Mm. But in this context, it doesn't work, because then what happens is that these things continue to go on and on and on, and the root causes are never understood or examined or changed. And of course, you know, and the women are just basically, again, silenced and voiceless and victims. And, you know, and that's not, this sounds like maybe some sort of hyperbole and some kind of rhetoric, but, you know, this really is the reality in these communities.
And that brings us also back to the idea of sort of staying and fighting or leaving as well. It's that if staying and fighting only has value if you think that there is something which can actually be fought. I mean, if the structures are so deeply rooted, if there's no way that they can be demolished and unpicked, then essentially, you're not left with any option. Essentially, you have to leave and rebuild from scratch as much as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a type of war, you know, that the women are engaged in with the men and, you know, the men in their community, men who are related to them, men who they often love and fear at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when that's the case, yeah, it's, you know, and you have no weapons, no arsenal of your own. What do you do?
And it's an interesting question, I think, for specifically for the communities, but also for society at large as well, because when the women are considering leaving, there's this kind of repeated question of where will we go? How will we know where we're going? And the subject of maps comes up quite a lot. Like, do we have? They don't have maps, and then there's a possibility that they might be able to find a map, but then they're not sure if they're going to be able to read the map. And that seemed to apply to sort of any. In any situation when you're trying to create something new, is that you have the sort of the familiarity of the structures you're holding you back, and you could stay and sort of attempt to dismantle them, or you have the kind of the great unknown.
And the
unknown can be kind of both terrifying and liberating, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, for the teenagers, you know, it's like, all right, let's go, you know, in a sense, you know, where the others are, you know, of course, more, you know, well, you know, pragmatic and thinking of all of the various logistics involved in staying and in leaving. The map thing, actually, little anecdote, was a detail that was given to me by my mother, who, you know, really has her ear to the ground when it comes to the Mennonite, you know, grapevine. And a friend of hers had been to this specific colony, the Manitoba colony, named after Manitoba, the province in Canada that I'm from and from there where they're from, but in Bolivia. A friend of hers had gone to this colony to visit, I think, a relative, or to maybe bring some supplies or something like that. And the teacher in the colony has said, yeah, we, you know, it would be so nice if we had a world map, you know, so nice to have a map. And I was just struck by, you know, by the just the enormity of that, you know, not knowing where you are in the world, and that it's a teacher in a school, you know, saying this. And all my life, I think, you know, aside from my, you know, rage at the man, I, you know, within my context and the world at large, the idea of the world has always been, and in my other work too, like the world, like this longing for the world, you know, which is, it's like a drug when you're a Mennonite and you're stuck in one of these communities. The world can only be something, you know, just so beautiful and joyful and fun and you know, inspiring and edifying in all sorts of ways. And I think that you know, when then you go into the world, you know, and you realize, ah, okay, I get it, you know. But then as a Mennonite, you know, and it's sort of inhabiting that limbo, you know, that kind of, or that, you know, liminal space of when I left, for instance, my community, and then was, you know, then thusly excommunicated later, I didn't belong in my community. I knew I couldn't be an individual in this community, but I also didn't belong in the world. The world was, you know, so it took a long time. I don't think it's actually ever, I think I still occupy that outer weird place, but it's, you know, it's especially hard for Mennonites. So again, you know, again, the stakes are so high if they leave, and, you know, what will happen? What will they experience?
And there's also the, because we find that is particularly in the teenagers, that sense of like kind of the fun and the sort of the how enticing the world can be. But it is true with the older generations, there's also this fear been inculcated as well about what the world could do to them, how the world will treat them. And that seems to be something. Is that something, do you think, which develops with age in these communities? Do you think it's something which is intentionally inculcated, or is it just a more sort of natural conservatism?
I mean, it could be both. I think that, you know, with age, I mean, I guess I can only think of my own older relatives or my parents. But again, you know, my own mother was always wanting to go. But my father, whom she was committed to in a very, you know, traditional Mennonite, it's not like she would have left without him. You know, he died, and that was when she left the community. And yet she longed to leave the community, like from a very, very early age, all throughout her, you know, old age. Well, I mean, she left in her 60s, but it's not old age, but, you know, middle age. And it didn't, and it only got stronger, her desire to leave. So, but I know that, you know, other people who, friends and family who have stayed in the community certainly have, they don't really understand what it is that I am hoping for or enjoying out there. You know, they want to stay, and they know that that's where they will stay, whether they feel that they belong there or not. You know, that's where they'll stay.
A lot of it seems to come down ultimately to the stories we tell each other, the stories we tell about ourselves, like whether it be the maps, sort of like either the fear or the excitement of plotting your own map, or the you know, the religious story, of course, but even within their conversation, one of the ways in which sophisticated ideas are communicated seems to be through little stories, little parables. So you have there's a story of the Rottweiler and the raccoons, or you have August talks about the, this is an analogy connected to the Black Sea and the sort of an underwater river. Is that something which is sort of comes quite naturally, do you think, to the Mennonite language, because it hasn't evolved beyond a certain point, and therefore it's kind of adapted in other ways?
I think so. That, and also, you know, their familiarity, our familiarity with the Bible, and, you know, it's, and it's many parables, and it's many stories, and it's many, you know, and metaphor, and you know, so then it's just a kind of natural extension to describe our lives in the same way, in the way that we're used to having life described for us, and thoughts, and also for these women, and the, you know, particularly in the remote Mennonite communities, stories about nature and the metaphors there, you know, with animals or skies or storms or weather or crops or, you know, the plants, because that's their world. You know, so and you know, I did have to remind myself of that, you know, you can't just lay down some metaphor of, you know, some, you know, traffic jam. Like it, yeah,
there's a moment where August remembers his father describing the twin pillars that guard the entrance to the shrine of religion as storytelling and cruelty, which really it really resonated. It really interested me. But then particularly connected to something you said earlier about the women are sort of creating their own religion. They're sort of like reinventing the Mennonite religion in their minds, their interpretation of it. And I just wondered if you could reflect a little bit on that idea of August's father. I mean, is that something which you broadly share, that these are the twin pillars of religion? Or is there potential in this, for example, in the action these women are taking to sort of reinvent religion with other pillars?
There is potential. There's always potential to reinvent religion with other pillars. But I feel at this point, I mean, the idea of religiosity, you know, is, yeah, I do believe that those are the two pillars, the shrine of, you know, of religion, storytelling and cruelty. I mean, we can see that. You know, but then within that, of course, is the idea of faith. You know, is the idea of hope and of thinking of oneself within a thinking, you know, and in particularly in this faith, and, you know, Christianity, I mean, you know, the idea of you know, living your life as Jesus would, for instance, you know, as this person, you know, who, you know, with humility and with kindness and with compassion and with selflessness. And these are all, I mean, you can think of those as religious concepts, like forgiveness too. We can think of it as a religious concept, and, you know, or a justice thing, and that it doesn't work. But in other ways, it does work, and it is necessary. You know, so I think that it's just, it's just not a black and white, it's just a white thing. It's, you know, a way of looking at religion. I mean, I know that the study of the Bible and the way of living one's life according to many the stories and, you know, in the Bible, and the kind of, you know, I would say rules, which I'm opposed to, and, you know, as a but other people would say inspiration, mm-hmm. you know, a kind of help in life, you know, strength giving. You know, that's a valid thing, mm-hmm. And I respect that. But you know, it's just we're just not there yet in terms of, you know, civilization. We have so far to go in so many different ways. But I'm hopeful that, you know, something will change. But maybe the world will come to an end before we actually get there.
On that point, and I will I'll hand over to audience questions in a moment because I'm sure you'll be keen to answer. But I just like to finish on the that particular subject of re-educating and refounding. And this is something that the women run up against in their conversation. This idea of what to do about the men and what to do about the boys. So the men of a certain generation, we almost get the sense that. Almost that they're a lost cause. I mean, there is a moment where one of the characters kind of says, well, you know, are they also just not as much victims as us? And then, you know, that provokes a certain discussion. But there's a lot of time spent deciding, okay, what do we do about the boys? Mm-hmm. And particularly boys of a sort of, you know, approaching adolescence, but from about like 12 to 15, about how
a slender margin, that tender age between boyhood and
that seems to be something which is sort of more broadly relevant as well beyond the Mennonite community. So who is responsible for educating boys differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the women grapple with that. Many of them have sons and brothers and what to do. And, you know, if they do decide to leave, I mean, the question is, well, who will come with us? And that's a part of the, you know, towards the end. I mean, there's a thing that happens, and again, they talk about the idea of 15, mm-hmm. Kind of being the cutoff, because that's the age of baptism or maybe, you know, 13 or 14 would be the cutoff. So if they're 15, they're baptized in the community and they are considered to be full members of the church with the right and to make decisions, to help make decisions in a sense, certainly, you know, to have some kind of a say, in the colony. So, do the women, and how would they convince anyway? How do you convince a 15-year-old boy, you know, to come with you? So one of the women has a plan and she, you know, sort of deploys that. But
without giving too much away.
Right, I don't know, that's a giveaway. But it's painful. I mean, everything is just, it's just so painful. It's just so fraught. I mean, the urgency that what they're attempting to do is to keep their children safe, is to prevent their children, their children, their daughters, especially their sons too, from being, you know, so harmed and systemically and systematically, and, you know, these crimes, and this is real, that, you know, they haven't stopped. Apparently rumors from the community are that these types of crimes with the anesthetic, etc., are continuing to happen, even though the original perpetrators are, you know, behind bars. And of course there's this 10-year kind of retrospective that the BBC did, the 10-year anniversary of the crimes, when the men were caught in 2009, now more than ever, the push is on. The community wants these men brought back to the colony to forgive them, so that they can go on to, again, to ensure their place in heaven, etc. And yet other rumors coming from the colony are that, the crimes are still happening. Incest, just abuse in every way, sexual, domestic violence. These numbers are so high in these places, as you can imagine, in these isolated places. So the women, I mean, you know, they're desperate. And this is something that imagine being, you know, in a position where you have children. You know, maybe it's one thing to take kind of forcibly, in a way, your young children with you, because of course that's what we do. We take our young children with us where we go. But an adolescent who's able to, it's not as easy. And
so much to unpick in that already constructed psychology. And that's
And then there's the talk too that, well, you know, maybe down the road, you know, after they've, you know, if they leave and if they establish another way of living, another life, another community, you know, some of these older kids, you know, and maybe even some of the women themselves who decide, you know, to not go, you know, will join them further down the road, maybe.
And that's it. In the end, there's no easy answers, and that's the thing. Like, the book doesn't try and provide them either. It's sort of like these, but it's the sort of the engagement and the conversation which carries it. I feel I could go on all evening, but I won't. If you have a question for Miriam, raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you.
What in the religion was used by the male elders to ask for acceptance of a crime of this magnitude, an ostensibly pacifist religion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is, and this is such a good one, what did the male elders use in terms of their religion or from the Bible or for justification, you know, for forgiveness or for a kind of, you know, overlooking these types of such horrific crimes, and again, I mean, the culture of control. I feel as though that fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible can be done in so many ways, so that they could say, for instance, on the one hand, and this is something that I'm familiar with in my own community, okay, you know, this shouldn't have happened, but you know, the devil, Satan, you know, if you are not a true believer, you know, and if your faith isn't strong enough, you know, then you will be visited by demons, by the devil, by, say, you know, this ridiculous language and thinking, and so clearly, you know, these men, you know, have our backsliders, their faith isn't, so we need to get them back into church, back into the faith, back into the community, so that they can, you know, continue to learn, you know, how to be better, you know, how to be better human beings worthy of going to heaven. And so, and a part of that, of course, would be that the women, you know, the victims forgive the men, understanding that, you know, we are sinners, we're all sinners, we know that, the Bible says that, you know, so it's easy to, you know, sort of say, well, I sin when I, you know, take a little bit of purple gas from my neighbor's farm thing, you know, or, you know, or I sin when I, you know, serially rape, you know, over 300 women in my community. And I think it's very easy. I think in that form of, like, kind of religious thinking, and it's a type of brainwashing, in my opinion, and denial, you know, that you just, it's sin. It's all like a kind of, it's sin, and we're sinners, and we need to be forgiven, and period.
Would similar standards be applied to women in the community for their transgressions?
Well, that's also good. No, I mean, you know, the women that I've known who have been excommunicated from their communities far outnumber the men. You know, women are, you know, easy come, easy go. Again, you know, commodities. Again, you know, as the women in my book say, are we actually of less value than the animals? I mean, the animals, when they're finished being useful, they can be traded at auction, or they can be killed and used for this, and this. You know, women just kind of get old and useless. What are we going to do after they've finished, you know, birthing 13 children or, you know, so it's, no, I mean, the women are always punished far more severely and with great relish, you know. This is, I think, a part of, you know, the pleasure. You could call it erotic pleasure, but I mean, you know, me, I go on and on. But, you know, certainly the pleasure of, you know, I feel, you know, and there's sickness there. And I'm not, you know, it's a sickness of the spirit. And it comes from, from all of the things that I've talked about. And I'm not the only, you know, person, Mennonite, who is talking about this. There's so many people writing it, and even religious Mennonites too, who are saying, look, we have to look at this, you know, we're like, you know, I think it's so easy to dismiss this kind of stuff because, again, the Mennonites themselves in the communities, but also the outsiders, to say, well, it's just happening to this weird group of people. It's almost, in a sense, not real. It's almost like they're not real people, and it's not really happening, and it's easy to forget about it. And, you know, And the Mennonite elders, of course, are relying on that as well, on the world turning away, you know, from them, as they have turned from the world.
I know that authors don't always get to choose the title of their books, but I have a feeling you might possibly have chosen this title. And I would just wonder whether you could talk a little bit about women talking and about the degree to which you think there actually is a place where just talking itself by women is uncontested. I'm not talking about necessarily what they say, but the fact of women talking.
Yeah, absolutely. I did choose the title, but it wasn't my first title. I had some other titles. The titles are hard, but and I like the title because, you know, when people say to me, well, it's just women talking. I mean, that's all. There's nothing really happens to them. You know, I'll say, yeah, but I, you know, you were warned. But I feel that the idea of women talking, I actually had it. You know, I really wasn't aware of the threat that represents to, you know, certain people, to certain men, maybe to women, to certain women as well, and particularly in my own community again, but I'm sure in the community at large, you know, the idea of a group of women getting together, you know, in a way, not even necessarily secretly, but, you know, in this case it is, but, you know, just getting a bunch of, well, you know, what are you talking about? What are you plotting? You know, what kind of overthrowing are you? What sort of rebellion? What sedition? You know, what's going on? And I think that, you know, this book specifically, you know, really struck fear into the hearts of that group of Mennonite elders that again always, you know, hates what I do, but this time, you know, it was really, you know, sort of discrediting me, but also saying, you know, how can you write this way about Mennonites, showing them to be such animals, such vicious, you know, rapists, and you know, so violent. How can you show that part of Mennonites? But there was never any mention from these same men, you know, never saying, oh, look at how these Mennonite women are being portrayed as women with agency, with a voice, or perhaps not immediately, but, you know, women attempting to determine for themselves what is going on in their lives exactly, and how they can change it, and how they can work together, and how they can talk, and how they can plan, and how they can, you know, there's never any mention of that, and they're Mennonites too. So when they say, how can you show Mennonites in this light, they're talking about men. You know, it's irrelevant what the Mennonite women are, you know, being portrayed as or being shown as to the world. And of course, you know, there's that constant, you know, how are we going to get people to join our church? It comes down to money so much of the time, of course. You know, how are we going to get Mennonites? How are we going to get people to become Mennonites, to join our churches, to begin tithing, you know, because Mennonites tithe, they give 10% of their income to the church, and or 15%, and you know, how are we going to keep our leaders, you know, like with a roof over their heads? I mean, so often these things come down to money, and I think that's a great fear, and of course the way that the world perceives them, you know, they're interested in having the world see them, us, as, you know, this very simple, you know, harmonious, loving, peaceful, hardworking, you know, group of people with strong faith, and that's it, you know. So, but again, so to go back to your original comment, yeah, and you know, and it's amazing to me, and I'm just learning this now at my advanced age, how threatening that is, a group of women, you know, just women getting together and talking.
I think we've got time for one more question, if anybody would like to. Yeah, that lady just there.
It's not related to this book, but your other books, and also my dad's from Friesland, so.
Wow, cool. Is he a Mennonite?
No.
That's okay.
But I did grow up in a small community, religious community. You talk a lot about, a lot of your books have a lot about mental illness and heart-wrenching mental illness, and I just wonder what place that comes from with you.
Well, I guess, I mean, if I'm not, you know, raging against, you know, the Mennonite hierarchy and that culture of control, and I also should say that, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, really beautiful things about Mennonites that I could talk about, but that's not really an interesting book. But you know, I've kind of, so many years, you know, been saying it's not the Mennonite people or the Mennonite faith that I'm critical of. It's the, you know, it is that culture of control. It is the fundamentalism, it's the misogyny. misogyny within the fundamentalism, et cetera, the authoritarianism. But mental illness, so aside from that theme that I seem to, circle around nonstop, ad nauseum, the theme of mental illness is something that I think about, that I am very, very curious about, that has affected my family in a profound way. I lost both my father and my sister to suicide. They both suffered deeply from my father from what was diagnosed as manic depression, but now is, of course, bipolar disorder all his life. And my sister, she wasn't diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but certainly with, deep clinical depression. And a cousin of mine, a very close cousin of mine, also took her own life. I will spend always, it's sort of, it kind of creates a fight inside of you to, the kind of like the onus is on me to, first of all, to appreciate my health, to say what I want to say, to live the kind of life that they weren't able to, and to sort of, in a way, kind of, balance things out in a sense by... they took the fight that they were and turned it on themselves, and I'm turning it on the men of the Manitoba colony. I don't mean to make light of this, but that self destruction. I feel that, and I don't have any other siblings, so I feel kind of like just to balance out the universe at all. Fight against and hopefully not turn it inward. But that's not a choice. Mental illness isn't a choice. Mental illness is an illness. And it affects us. It affects us all. And so many people that I know and love. And so it'll just always, it's just a huge part of me, really. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That is all we've got time for, unfortunately. But stick around, have a glass of wine with us, cool down with a glass of wine. We have plenty of copies of Women Talking available at the front desk. Miriam will be here signing them for you. So continue the conversation with Miriam, with each other, and join me one more time in saying a big, big thank you to Miriam Taves.